So just before I introduce Nick, I thought I would like to thank very much the two organizers of this event, our two current interns, who is Pandita and Bruno. Did a great job. We're a fantastic team. Brilliant. And so finally, today we're going to look at the 15th chapter, not the sexiest chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, but actually a surprisingly profound one. Generally people go for the big splashes like the universal form and that kind of thing. So Nick has, take this one off, just give you a clean sheet, so to speak. So Nick is going to talk to us about the 15th chapter and looking at its relevance with regard to divinity. So Dr. Nick Sutton, head of the Continuing Education Department of the Oxford Centre.
Thanks. Right. What I think we can do is maybe we can read it together. Everybody okay with Sanskrit? How many people here speak Gujarati? Okay, and there's a couple of Tamil speakers as well. Okay, well, if you know Gujarati, you're halfway to Sanskrit, aren't you? Are you all right with reading a verse each? In Sanskrit and English, or do you feel? I know when they have
we did it in Harrow, didn't we?
We did it in Harrow. If you can do it in Harrow, you can do it anywhere, can't you? I know I was at Birmingham University, the students group on Thursday night, and it was a Hanuman Chalisa one, and essentially it was a recital of the Hanuman Chalisa, and I was speaking to the head of the society afterwards, who's from Mumbai, so he's a Hindi speaker, and I'm always curious. So I said, do you understand any of this? And even as a Hindi speaker, he said, no, he couldn't understand the Hanuman Chalisa. But at the same time, the feeling was that just the recital of the sound was a positive, auspicious activity. So maybe it'd be a good thing to recite some of the Bhagavad Gita, like their Bhagavad Gita at the Lakshmi Narayan Temple, at Bhagavad Gita Day, where they just recite the Sanskrit text over and over again with the priest, probably not really understanding the meaning, but just the sound is believed to have a purifying effect. So, should we do that?
Can you start?
Shall I start? Okay. All right.
And then we'll go around that way.
Should we do it together then?
Yeah.
Okay, right. I think what I'm going to do is, first of all, we'll go through the whole chapter because I have this terrible fear that we'll get embroiled in verse 3 and we won't make any progress beyond that. So I think what we'll do is we'll make sure we at least finish the chapter and then we can go back and explore the specific meaning. It's important to finish it because my feeling is that the 15th chapter is a work in its own right. It's got a nice discrete form which needs to be covered. It's covering a specific topic and it's doing it very, very well. But we can explore that later on. Let's just go through the meaning of the verses. All right? What should we do? Should we chant it or just say it? Let's just say it, because we'll all be singing the wrong tune. Okay, ready? Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Urdvamulam Adahashakam Ashvatam Prahuravyayam Chandansi Yasya Parnani Yastam Veda Savedavit. Now then, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha is fairly straightforward. Bhagavan is Krishna, although it's interesting in the Gita he's always named as Bhagavan. In other passages of the Mahabharata it says Sri Krishna Uvacha, but or even Krishna Uvacha in some places. Here it's Bhagavan Uvacha. Uvacha comes from the verb voch, to speak. What about these words? Urdva. Do you know that word? No? Urdva means upwards. Mula, is that familiar? Sorry? Mula is root, yes. So roots upwards. Adaha. Means downwards. So roots up, shaka. Branches, yes, branches. We can't have leaves because we've got another word for leaves. So it's roots upwards, branches downwards. Ashvatam prahur avaya. Prahur means they speak. What about ashvata? Anybody come across this word before? It's a type of tree.
Everyone, you're saying people tree.
People tree. Yeah, what is that the same as a banyan tree?
No.
It's like it. Does it have the same thing with the branches coming down and rooting again?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this Ashvata tree with its roots upwards, its branches downwards. Avyaya? It means not fading away, eternal, constant. Sorry?
By itself.
By itself.
It's Avyaya.
Avyaya means to pass away, to dwindle. So avyaya means it doesn't dwindle. It remains always constant. And I think this next bit's interesting. Chandangsi yasya parnani. Now, parna. Is that familiar at all? Parna? It's a leaf. What's a Gujarati word for leaf?
Pan.
Yeah. So it's the same, isn't it? Just a little bit fancier in Sanskrit. Chandangsi, and the chandas are?
Hymns.
Sorry?
The hymns?
The hymns, yeah. Of which, of this tree, the leaves of the tree are the hymns, and specifically it means the Vedic hymns. Yastam Veda, one who knows that, sa, he is Vedavit. So one who knows this tree, he is the knower of the Vedas. To understand that tree is to know the Vedas. Draw your attention to the fact that within this tree, the Vedic hymns are the leaves of the tree. I think that's significant when we understand what the tree represents. Oh, we've got a different meter now, so we'll have to have a go with this one. This is a Trishtub meter. Most of the verses are shlokas, but this one, I think, is Trishtub, a different type of meter. You ready? Adashtur from prasritas tajishaka. Guna pravrida vishoya pravala adashchumulanyanu santatani karmanu bandhini manushaloke. Yes, shaka again is the branches. Adashcha urdvam, they spread downwards and upwards. Prasrita means they spread. So the branches spread down and they spread up. Guna pravrida, they are nourished by the gunas. Does everybody know what the gunas are? Sattvam, rajas and tamas. What do they actually mean though? What's sattva? Goodness. Yeah, good in the sense that it's a sort of
truthfulness.
Yeah, what again is, what's a sort of person who's dominated by sattva like?
He's enlightened.
Enlightened. Mmm, well.
Yeah.
Boring. Not necessarily boring. You can be interesting and sattvic. Yeah, I mean.
Be unpopular by telling the truth all the time.
Unpopular by telling the truth all the time. We can discuss that in relation to Krishna, can't we? Krishna's, yeah, he's popular and he doesn't. Yeah, it's basically pure, enlightened to some extent, filled with goodness, virtue, etc. It's the positive things. And the gunas, they are thought to pervade all aspects of our personality and the world as a whole. So nourished by the gunas, the branches, and vishoya pravala. It shoots, the pravala are the vishaya, the objects of the senses. Again, with the Gita so much, I don't want to overcomplicate things, so much of the Bhagavad Gita is based on a system of philosophy called Sankhya. And all these concepts like vishaya and guna are derived from Sankhya philosophy. What would the vishayas be then, the objects of the senses? What are the senses, first of all? How many senses have we got? Five.
Five.
And the six is the mind. Very good, yeah. And well, that's mentioned later on, actually. And what are the five senses?
Touch.
Taste. Yeah. Sight. Hearing. Smell. And taste. So what are the objects of the senses, then? Well, yeah, they are the senses themselves, but what's the objects they perceive? What does the ear perceive? Sound is one object. And another would be, therefore, aroma, flavour, or flavour, taste, touch sensations, etc. That each one has an object in, which are analysed in Sankhya. So these Vishayas, they are the shoots which give rise to this tree. Again, what is the tree representing? This inverted Ashvata tree. What does it actually represent? What's the first bit of the chapter about?
This world.
Excellent. Yeah, it is. This first part is about this world. And therefore, why did I suggest it might be significant that Chandangsi Yasya Parnani, that the leaves of the tree are the hymns of the Veda? Why is that significant if the tree symbolizes this world? What's it saying about the Vedas?
It belongs to the world.
It belongs to the world, and therefore, where does it not belong? The point. Anyway, we'll come on to that a little bit. I think it's really interesting because it positions the Gita in relation to the Vedas. And the question then arises, is the Gita positive about the Vedas, or does it have a negative attitude towards the Vedas? And I think, again, I contextualise that because in ancient India there was very strong pro-Vedic tendencies, but there were also very significant anti-Vedic tendencies. So who would be leading the anti-Vedic tendencies? Who are these people? Buddhists, yeah. Anyone else?
Jains,
yeah, there's legions of them.
Atheists.
Well, that could be Jains as well. Yeah, but they were Charvaks, weren't they? Rationalists, skeptics. What about Hindus?
There are some.
Sorry,
Nitin. Some Hindus.
Yeah.
Lingayats
later on. I think, though, this is something that interests me in the Mahabharata. You do find passages in which a teacher comes forward and he challenges the Vedic ritualists. What's the particular issue on which people might challenge the Vedic ritual? Why would they
sacrifice,
and particularly on the grounds of ahimsa, exactly right. And it's often represented that this is a Buddhist or a Jain attack on Hinduism. But again, it's that kind of simplistic tendency to kind of draw lines. In fact, there were many voices from within the Hindu tradition who were expressing exactly those same views. And I can find at least half a dozen passages within the Mahabharata where people speaking from a Hindu perspective criticize and reject the violence of the Vedic ritual. Also the worldliness of it, in the sense that the Vedic ritual is designed for prosperity, or it seeks to convey prosperity in the here and now. So it's regarded as worldly. I think the Gita's perspective on this is interesting. That's why I say, Chandangsi Yasya Parnani, the leaves of this tree of this world are the Vedic, are the hymns of the Veda. And as we come on more, Adushya Mulani Anu Santatani, downwards as well, spread the roots, Karmanu Bandini. Manushya Loke means, Manushya is?
Mankind.
And Loka is? The world, yeah. In the world of humanity, Karma Anu Bandini. Anubanda is that a word at all? Yes, bound. And what binds you in this world of humanity?
Karma.
Yes, we're bound by karma. So is it taking a positive view of the world tree? Karmanu bandini manushya loke. No, not particular. It's what binds us. But what does, again, that come back to that point about the Vedas? What's their role?
This is quite negative, the way that Vedas, yeah. Isn't it? Because is this suggesting Vedas are not Smriti? And they're not from outside the world.
Exactly right. Yes, exactly right.
Which is in direct opposition to orthodoxy.
To some extent, yes.
Because the Vedas are heard and they're from Akasha, they're not human.
And I think so. And I think it's really interesting, though, the way that the Gita steers a middle path between the out-and-out rejection of groups of images like the Buddhists and the Jains and the rigid orthodoxy of the Mimamsavadins that Shankara opposed centuries later. The Gita steers that middle course. It doesn't deny the Vedas, but at the same time, it certainly doesn't embody the Vedic orthodoxy. Let's read on a bit more, and we'll see how it develops that theme. Again, the Vedas, Tim's being a part of the world. Shall we read verse 3? Narupamasyehatatopalabhyate. Come on, everybody. Nachasampratishta. Ashvatamenam suvirudamulam asanga shastrena dridhena chitva. Yeah, narupa. Rupa means form. Yeah, no form of this tree can be detected. You can't find it. It just goes on and on and on. In other words, our entanglement in this world has no beginning, no end. You can't draw constraining lines around it. It has no form. Anto means no end. Natcha adi, and no adi is no end, no beginning. And natcha sampratishta, no foundation. You can't sort of draw lines around and say this is where it begins, this is where it ends, etc. It's essentially without recognizable form. Ashvatam enam suviruda mulam. Suviruda mulam means it's got very firm roots. What does that? Why do you think Krishna says that it's got such firm roots? What's he implying there?
The attachment
is
deep-rooted.
Deep-rooted. Yeah, deep-rooted might even be a better translation. It's very strong. You can't just pull it up like you can a dandelion or something. I don't think dandelions are that easy to pull up, actually. But, you know, some easy flowers to pull up. It's firmly, deeply rooted there. Suviruda mulam, ashvatamenam, this ashvata tree. So what should you do with it? Chitva. Anybody recognise that word? Chit. Chit. Sorry? Is that a Gujarati word as well? Cut.
No.
Yes, but anyway, you cut it down. You can't pull it up because it's suviruda mulam. Therefore, you chop it down. And what should you use to chop it down? A shastra. A weapon. Yeah, and what does that weapon consist of? A sangha shastra, which means sangha is
attachment.
Asanga is detachment, and dridha means the strong or firm weapon of attachment. You should cut down this tree. But again, I'll go back to that point. Chandangsi yasya parnani. So what's included in being cut down?
The
Vedas.
Are we including the Upanishads?
No.
There are some chapters of the Upanishads. Or not some verses.
Well, it does say Chandangsi, and the Chandas in the Vedas would usually be the hymns which form part of the Karmakand portion. I don't think Krishna is here talking about the Upanishads, not least because he quotes the Upanishads on several occasions within this very chapter. So he would be a bit self-contradictory if he said, cut down the Upanishads, which I'm now just using to support my thesis here. So probably not. No, I think he does mean the ritualistic portion of the Vedas. Okay. Now then, why should we cut down this tree? Should we do verse 4? Uh-huh. Tataha param tat parimargitavyam yasmingatana nivartante buyah tameva chadyam purusham prapadye yataha prabriddhihi prasrita purani. Okay, having cut down this tree, one should go to that position which once attained, Yasmin Gata, when you've gone there, Nanivartanti. Nanivartanti would be? You never come back again. So what's Krishna talking about here? Tataham padam tat parimargitavyam, Yasmin Gata, Nanivartanti. What's the
spiritual
and therefore moksha, leaving this tree, the world symbolized by the tree, and going to that place from which there is no return. What's he really talking about there? Why does he emphasize this return, buyaha, again? What's the idea of where does one return?
Reincarnation.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, reincarnation. The idea that embodied in the Gita that if after death you're reborn in a different state of life. But he's saying here, if you can use the firm weapon of detachment and cut down the tree, you don't come back. You go to that place, na nivartanti buyaha. And it describes it there, not as so much a place. Tameva, that indeed, Adyam Purusham. What does Purush mean? Yeah, it's got a, in Gujarati, I think, it's got a gender.
It's a man.
It means a man. I think in when it's used in the Gita, it means the person. I don't think it's gendered in that sense. And you should prapadye, surrender to that Adyam Purusha, surrender to that original person. Therefore, again, going back to what Anu was saying this morning about the different readings, the use of the word Purusha there is giving a personal identity to some extent. This is the voice of the person or what he thinks. I surrender to that original being out of whom flowed forth the primeval creative impulse. So this is the person who's cut down the tree with the firm weapon of attachment. Prapadye, I surrender to that Adyam Purusham, to that original person. Who is that original person?
God.
What?
God.
Does he have a name?
Brahman.
Who? Brahman. Yes. Okay, well, we'll read on and see if Krishna puts a name on this. Yes.
You know, you said there was no creation. It's never, you know, no ending. And here is a creative impulse.
Yeah, it says, yataha prabritihi prasrita. I think it the wording gives the sense not like the Christian creator God, who, I don't know if there is a real Christian, but I always, when I was a child as a Christian, I always got this sense of someone, a person kind of making clay models or things that were, you know, my childlike vision that he created it out of nothing and he made it and he formed it. I think with the Gita's vision of the world, it's very much a flowing outwards from the deity himself. It's almost an expansion from him. But it doesn't have a particular point in time when it begins because it relates to the deity himself. So it's constant there, but the original source is the deity there. But I don't think it's taken, the wording there isn't of a creator. It's about a flowing forth of the world emerging from him. Okay, and here we are. Again, let's do five then. Nirmana mohajita sangha dosha adiyatma nitya vinivritta kamaha Dvanvoer vimuktaha sukha dukhukha samgair gach chantyamudaha padamavyayam tat. Yeah, this is not just about this world. It's about escaping from this world. How you do it. Release from the karmanu bandini, the bondage of karma. Again, that's interesting. And this is a constant mistake I always get with students doing the introduction to Hinduism class. They always think you get moksha from good karma. They always put that in their essays there. Is that right? If I'm a very righteous person, I build up my stock of punya, I'll eventually get moksha?
Nishkama karma.
Nishkama karma, yeah. What happens if I do lots of righteous activities? Can't I possibly get moksha? So what's the key to moksha? Is it my goodness or my detachedness? Well, what happens to a person who is morally upstanding in the future? Are they going to get moksha as a result of their morality? Will someone weigh up my good deeds inside?
No, it's just taking off what he did in the previous life.
Okay, so it's just sort of counteracting the negative.
But you don't counteract the negative. You still have to pay for anything you've done negative. You could still be doing a lot of good, but
does that mean you can't escape from the Because a priest promised me if I paid him that amount of rupees, he would wipe out all my negative karma for me.
You enjoy the pleasures and then you're reborn again.
I think that's the point, isn't it? Good karma leads to pleasant rebirth, and all of us here, sitting here, enjoying the fruits of the good life in our wealth. I was thinking that when I was in India, driving in my big air-conditioned taxi, looking out of the window, thinking at all the people there, the hundreds of thousands of people, most of whom will never get the opportunity to ride in a taxi of this kind, and how me and my unworthy children take all of that for granted, of course, until I tell them and make them feel bad about it. But there is that. We're enjoying the fruits of our previous righteous activities in some way. But of course, they don't last forever, do they? And at some point we'll be the ones looking in at the taxi from the outside, wishing, I wish I was in that air-conditioned taxi and not having to wait for the bus to come with 100 other people to cram on. Yes, so, no, karma doesn't lead, good or bad, does not lead to moksha. It's detachment from the world. And this final verse of this set, Nirmana Moha, describes the way in which this detachment, if you like, is executed. Nirmana moha, free of pride, mana, free of folly, moha, jitta sangha dosha, conquering the fault or the problem of attachment, adiyatma nitya, constantly absorbed in spiritual matters, vinivritta karma, what karma is, desire, vinivritta karmaha, banishing those materialistic desires. Dvandva means duality. And vimukta is free from duality. And the duality is designated as sukha and dukkha. I think the idea being is that, yeah, you're sort of above and aloof. Our lives are constantly beset by up and downs, but he's saying the ideal state of mind is that aloofness above the sukha and the dukkha. And then the amudas are the subject in the last line. What's a muda? Does anybody know that word? An ass. Yes. A fool, an idiot, a stupid person. So an amuda is... Yes, a wise person. And where do they go? They go to they get shanti padam avyayam tat. They go to that unchanging place. Okay, so Krishna, in that opening quarter of the chapter, he's described the tree, the binding tree of this world, and he's described the necessity of escaping from that and the means by which one escapes, which is using the weapon of absolute detachment. In verse 6, now we're back with shloka verses. Sorry, it's on two pages. He quotes, I think, from several Upanishads, probably the Shvetashvatara and probably the Kutta as well. He takes this verse from to show that Krishna is a very good Upanishadic scholar, which again, I don't think he's rejecting the Upanishads. He describes this higher world, this Padamavyoyam Tat, this unfading, unchanging world. Should we do that verse then? Natadbhasa yati suryo nashyashanko napavakaha yadgatvana nivartante tadhama paramamama. Yes, bhasa is bhasa yate. No, not bhasa. Bhasa, there's one slight difference in a letter. Bhasa is illumination. So, na tad bhasa yate. This is not, what does not illuminate this place? Surya, the sun. Na shashanka. Usually it would be chandra, but it's not got enough syllables to get the meter, so Krishna has used shashankaha instead, which is the moon. Napavakaha. Again, he might have used Agni, but he's gone for Pavaka. Fire. So what's he saying about this higher abode? It's not illuminated by fire. Okay, but does that mean it's dark there? No, it has its own spiritually luminous potency. And Yadgatvana Nivartante, again making that point, having gone there, you don't return. Tad Dharma. What's a Dharma? Yes, an abode, a place. Paramam. Yes, the highest, supreme. And mama means? Mine. Yes, so who's being introduced into the discourse here? God. Krishna is introducing himself. And that's why I asked earlier, do we know the name of this God? What's Krishna claiming here? He is that supreme Adyam Purusham. And that becomes increasingly apparent. Now, we'll see later on how this develops. I think the next verse, number 7, is particularly significant in light of the discussion that Anu presented earlier. So let's have a look at that one. Ready? Mama evangsho jiva loke jiva bhutaha sanatanaha manaha shastani indriyani prakritistani karshati. The subject's changed now. He's not talking just... What's the word for this world? What's this world consist of? In Sankhya. Jiva... Well, this is Jiva Loka, but what would it be consisting of? What's matter? What's the word for matter? Prakriti. Krishna is the tree, if you like, the Ashvata tree with its binding roots. That is the world of matter. That is the world of Prakriti. Krishna here is talking about something different. The subject's changed in verse 7 to the Jiva Bhuta. What's the Jiva Bhuta? Sorry. The soul, yes. What would be another word for it then? The Atman, yes. The Jiva Bhutaha. Okay, he's talking about that. That's the subject of the sentence. Sanatanaha is eternal. The eternal Jiva Bhuta. Okay. Jiva Loke, it exists in the world of living beings. But what is it? And that's where this first compound is significant. Mama Eva Angsha. Mama again is, yes, of me. Eva, just it's added for to give emphasis. Nothing more than Mama, Eva, and Angsha. What's Angsha mean? A part. Yes, a part. So what's Krishna saying about the Jiva in relation to himself? It's a part of him, yeah. And that's therefore he's defining in this verse the relationship between the Jiva and himself as the deity. So what is that relationship? Is it one of identity or difference? As Anu was saying this morning, we turn the page over now. He was saying, is it all one or is it two? Two? Three. Three. Wait, you're getting ahead of yourself.
One and two.
One and two, says, yes, very good, philosopher. One and two, exactly. And which Indian theologian, philosopher is the one and two theologian? We've got Anu mentioned this morning, he said he was... It's Ramanuja, yeah. He's a one and two. Madhva is the out and out two, people. If you ever see a picture of Madhva, he's always got the two fingers like this. Absolute duality. Soul is one thing, God is the other. Never the two shall meet. I was talking to Krishna before that we were saying, doesn't he? He translates that passage of the Upanishads, Tattvamasi. He says, no, you've misread that. It actually means a Tattvamasi. Not that's what you are, that's what you're not. The sort of absolute antithesis of Shankara. Two things. But Ramanuj negotiates a pleasing middle course between them. And he says that the identity is the identity of the part and the whole. Is the part the same as the whole? Is it different from the whole? It's like the drop of seawater if you take a jam jar. Or even Jyoti. Jyoti, when we went to Tibet, you brought me back a a jam jar from Manasa Sarovara, which I still have actually, although some of it has evaporated. But have I got Manasa Sarovara in my room on my windowsill? But what's in that jam jar is nothing but Manasa Sarovara, unless, you know, so long as Jyoti did really fill it up and didn't fill it up at the airport, realising she'd forgotten. Well, that's another debate. Does it matter if it's real or not? So long as I... But anyway, that's not what we're... But the point is, Krishna is defining the relationship here as the part to the whole. Now, Ramanuja's philosophy is called... I don't want to go too much into technical... Visishtadvaita, which means partial, qualified, or limited Advaita. So he shares with Shankara the idea that your soul is nothing but God. It's absolutely the same as God. There is no difference between the jam jar of water I have and the lake high in the Himalayas. But of course, there is it's nothing but that lake's water. But of course, there is a difference in as much as that lake is vast, cold, and deep, whereas my little jam jar is small and lacks, obviously, the same potency of the lake. So in one sense, although the individual Jiva Bhuta can claim, I am Krishna, and Krishna can say, Aham Atma, which he does say in the 10th chapter, I am the self, that's not an absolute equation, because the identity of the part to the whole is not absolute. It's partial or limited. So I would suggest that this chapter... this verse goes a long way towards supporting Ramanuja's position. And as another thing Anu pointed out is when she said that you mentioned the Ramakrishna mission. And I can only confirm that whenever I'm book shopping and I see a publication from the Ramakrishna mission, I always think, oh, I'm in for a bargain here. So I've got Shankara's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, which I bought a couple of years ago, ₹180, which I think is... £2 about, just over £2 for a full hardback book. And I've also got Ramanuja's commentary, ₹125. So that's about, £1.50 for these. Fantastic bargains. But it's got verse by verse commentary by Ramanuja, verse by verse commentary by Shankara. And it's a fascinating exercise. Well, I find it fascinating anyway, but maybe my life is a little dull. But nothing, just to go through the text and compare the interpretations. We have a whale of a time in my house. So I'm sattvic and dull. I'd rather be rajasic and exciting, I think. Yes, so the Jiva Bhuta are part of the deity, a part of Krishna. Manahashastan Indriyani, it becomes, it resides within Prakriti, Prakriti Stani, with, surrounded by the six senses, Manahashastan Indriya, of which, as you said, the mind is the sixth sense. So there it is. And now then, Krishna carries on. And are we running short of time, Shanak? Okay. What? Yeah, but I don't know what time I'm supposed to finish. So, I just don't want to get... We get up to verse 16 and everyone's, you know, like the last few verses of the Mahabharata, which would be... which you don't read them. It's got that lovely dog story as well, hasn't it, the last one? You know, Yudhishthira's finest hour when he you grew up never knowing that. You know. Anyway, let's move on to verse 8. Okay, ready? Shariram yad avapnoti yachapyut kramatishvaraha grihit vaitani sangyati vayurgandhani vashayat. Lovely metaphor here, vayurgandhani vashayat. Yeah, shariram. Sharira means?
Body.
Yeah, avapnoti. So the Jiva Bhuta accepts a body. But what does it... he moves out from it. He departs from the body. But what's the word used for the Jiva Bhuta here at the end of the line? It's Ishvar. Now. Yeah, what does Ishvar mean? It means God. So here, in the previous verse, you can see in line 7 at the top, it said Jiva Bhuta. There's been no change of subject. But here, the noun in the nominative case, the subject here, is the same thing, is designated as Ishvar. So Jiva Bhuta is Ishvara. Now, Shankaracharya is naturally going to interpret... I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I can't be certain of this, but one would suspect that Shankara would say that demonstrates the absolute unity of Atman and Brahman, because the Jiva Bhuta is here, the Ishvara as well. But being as how Krishna's... And perhaps he did, because Krishna said it's a part of him, and therefore Ishvara isn't an entirely inappropriate designation. But it does suggest a significant degree of unity between the self and the absolute. The fact that Krishna is here using the word Ishvara, not for himself, but for the Jiva Bhuta. So, having acquired a body, then when it departs, it travels on and it carries with it certain sensations as the wind carries aromas. And I think this is a complex question about the process of rebirth, right? What do we take with us when death comes? And I think the example, the metaphor, if you like, Krishna's using here, it's like the wind blowing over different places. And sometimes the wind will blow over a field of hyacinths. We've got hyacinths in our garden. The wind comes in on a summer's day. You can smell it. It carries that sweet aroma with it. It brings with it. But if you're unfortunate enough to live next door to a pig farm or something, and the wind is coming from the direction of the pig farm, it'll carry the piggy smells with it. So in the same way, the wind is not the same as the hyacinths or the pigs, but it carries with it the sensation of where it's been. And in the same way, the departing soul carries with it the sensations, the impressions that it's drawn up in its life, just as the air draws the aroma of the place it's been into itself and carries it forward into its next location. Similarly, the Jiva Bhuta carries with it sensations and carries them on into the next life.
Sanskar, isn't it?
That's the word in yogic terms. Yeah, it's fascinating. I was going to mention a little bit about that, but we'll get sidetracked. But, I mean, it was a bit like what Anu was talking about, the application. I think, what the Gita does, just like Vivekananda applied Vedanta to the world and showed how Vedanta wasn't just some esoteric doctrine, but it had a real immediate implications for the way we live and treat others. I think one thing that Krishna's doing in the Gita is taking yoga philosophy, and again in the Yoga Sutras it's very esoteric and it's about a mystical technique. In the Gita, Krishna takes yogic ideas and applies them to the way we live our lives there. So yeah, he's talking about the sanskars or the vasanas, isn't it? That's the other word. The impressions on the consciousness that the soul carries with it into the next life. And that's why it's always a good idea to be in good place. I was reading that thing, that everything you've ever seen, heard or experienced, it's never lost. It's always there to something. So... that's when I'm watching television, I always turn the sound down on the adverts because there are some sanskars, some bad smells coming out of that television that you don't want to carry with you into any next day, let alone the next life. verse 9. Here's the senses. Ready? Shrotram chakshuhu sparshanam cha rasanam ghranam eva cha adishtaya manaschayam vishayan upasevate. Okay, he lists all the senses there. We've had them already. Hearing, sight, chakshu, sparshana, touch, rasa, taste, and ghrana, aroma. He then, and through these, they're located on the mind. And again, we could go into the complexities of Sankhya analysis of the workings of the mind, the way the senses draw information to be analysed by the mind and assessed by the intellect. And then this way, through these senses, the Jiva Bhuta, now located in Prakriti, experiences the objects of the world. He enjoys the sounds, he tastes the tastes, he smells the smells, etc. Not the Jiva Bhuta directly, because the Jiva Bhuta is transcendent to the world, but through the medium of the mind and senses, the world is experienced. Now then, again, I mentioned yoga before. Krishna having established the identity of the Jiva Bhuta, the soul, how to perceive this entity? The answer is by yoga. So let's have a look at verse 11. We are halfway through now. Ready? Yatanto yoginus chayanam pasyantyatmanya vastitam yatanto pyakritatmano noinam pasyantya chetasaha. Lovely balance, isn't there, in the wording? Pashyanti. That's the verb in this. Has anybody encountered that word before? Pashyanti. You mean to see? Yes. So, who sees? Yogins, the endeavouring yogins, and they see this. He doesn't usually say they understand it, but he uses the word pashyanti. They actually see it. And where is it? Atmani avastitam. Atmani. Anybody here do Latin at school? Did you? Mm-hmm. I did Latin as well. I got hit a lot in Latin at my school. That was my teacher's best pedagogical technique, was battering you around the head or pulling your hair and stuff like that. Did no good. Anyway, this is locative case. In Sanskrit, that means where it is. So where is the Jiva Bhuta? Atmani. It's within yourself. I don't think it means Atman here in the sense of the soul, but I think it means it's within yourself. The yogins see the self. They see the Atman. They see the Jiva Bhuta within themselves. And I think it's impossible to overstate the importance of yoga notions in classical Indian thought. These early texts, like the Upanishads, to some extent the Upanishads, but certainly the Gita, pervaded by yogic ideas. And we were even talking before about the Alawars. Well, you know, that Vaishnavism, early Vaishnavism, is predominated by yogic ideas. So yoga isn't just an obscure subpart of Hinduism. It's really right at the very heart of the Hindu revelation. So the yogins, they see the Jiva Bhuta, within themselves, but because they're endeavouring to do so, yatanto, but one who is akritat manaha, that means, I don't know what you'd say really, not self-controlled. You know, he's a loose character, no self-control, a bit rough and ready, not mastering the self. Nainam pasyanti achetas. He's stupid, he's achetas. He hasn't got that level by which he can practice. It's not that, I think the point he's making here is that the akritatmanaha, the achetasaha, nainam pasyanti, they will never see it. Even though they make the endeavour, yatanta, they won't achieve success. And I think the point he's making here is that it's not just that anybody out on the street, you can't walk into the bar and say, anybody fancy a bit of yoga, and everybody comes down and does it, and then, oh, I've just seen the Atman within the sun. It's not like that. There has to be a developed level of consciousness as a platform for the beginning of the practice of yoga. I think Krishna's here inserting a caveat. Don't think anybody can just rush home this afternoon and have a glance at the Atman. You've got this sort of extensive preparation there. And I think that really concludes Krishna's discussion of the Jiva Bhuta. And as Shanak mentioned before he walked out of the talk, he mentioned three. And I think we're coming to three. We've had two so far, two topics. What have been the two topics so far? We had the tree to start with, and then the Jiva Bhuta. Yes, so we've had the world of matter, Prakriti, and we've had the soul, the Jiva Bhuta. Now then, the next few verses, we have topic number three. And that's why I think Shonak was right when he mentioned three. He wasn't just being frivolous. So let's have a look at verse 12. And some of these verses might be familiar coming up. Okay, 12. Ready? Yadaritya gatam tejo jagad bhasa yate kilam yachchandramasi yachchagnau tat tejo vidi mamakam. You hear Krishna's talking about tejas, energy, power, the power of the world. Aditya gatam. What's aditya? Anybody? It is the sun. So it's the energy of the sun, the Aditya Gautam Teja. Yeah, it, what does it do? Jagat Bhasya Teki Lam. It illuminates the Jagat. Jagat is the world, yeah. That energy of the sun coming from the sun, Aditya Gata, which illuminates the entire world, Akila Jagat. And then Yachchandramasi, the moon, yeah. Yachchagnau, Agnau is fire. So these luminous energies coming from the sun, from the moon, from fire, Taptaja, that energy, Vidi, you must know. It's imperative case for those of us who did study Latin. We know that, don't we? It's an order, Vidi. Do it, understand it, Marmakam. Marmakam means it's mine. It's really from me. The sun, the energy of the moon, the energy of fire, that is really a reflection of my energy. I think, what's Krishna starting to talk about here then? He's talked about the world, he's talked about the individual soul.
His world.
Sorry?
His world.
His world. Yes, and even more than perhaps his world.
Big lake.
His what?
The big lake.
I think, well, maybe it hasn't become clear.
As opposed to the smaller bit of water.
Oh, I see. Yes, exactly right. Yeah, I wasn't going to say no, but I didn't really understand the idea of the lake. Yeah, he's talking about the absolute. He's talking about himself. Vidimamakam. And increasingly now, he's starting to speak in the first person. I and me. Vidi Marmakam, it's from me. And again, he goes on, and really he's talking specifically about the way he brings life to the world. The lifeless matter of the world is empowered and energized by Krishna's own presence within it. Again, Anu mentioned this morning that verse, I pervade the world like pearls on a thread. The reason why the world is not lifeless matter, it's pulsating with energy. That pulsating energy is the presence of the deity within it. So again, we were talking at lunchtime about the Christian and the and Hindu ideas of divinity. I think this is perhaps one of the distinctions between them, in as much as the Abrahamic religion's idea of divinity is of a remote transcendent God, particularly in Islamic theology, God is absolutely, utterly transcendent. In Hindu thought, except perhaps with Madhva, you've got God is absolutely immanent. It's not that he's somewhere up there and out there. His energy, his presence pervades the whole world. He is the energy that makes the world what it is. Okay, and he goes on with this theme. So verse 13. Gama visha chabhutani dharyam yaham ojasa pushnami chausha dihi sarvaha somo bhutvara satmakaha. It's very interesting, this. Ga is actually, I think it's related to the word for a cow, but I think it means the earth. So gam and vish is the verb avish, is to enter, entering into the earth. Gama visha, cha bhutani, dharayami aham. Again, first person, aham is I. I maintain all living beings, ojasa, with my power, with my energy, with my potency. I enter this earth and I sustain the life of all living beings. How does he do that? Pushnami chaushadi sarvaha. Chaushadi, oshadi. Is that a word anyone's familiar with?
Medicine.
Yeah, I think it's got, you're right. And then, of course, in Indian medicine, that would be herbs and plants. But oshadi means the plants, the vegetables. So Krishna, pushnami means to nourish them, to bring life. All the plants, the vegetational life, is nourished by Krishna. Again, Soma Bhutva. Soma here means? Yes, it's the moon. Rasatmakaha. Imbued with rasa, liquid potency. It's an interesting idea. I don't know if I was talking to someone, a gardener, who said this idea is shared in the West, the idea that the moon is somehow the force that nourishes plant life, that they derive energy from the moon, and the growth of plants is related to the cycles of the moon. I don't know if that, there's any truth in that, but certainly in Indian thought, the richness of plant life is thought to be nurtured by the light and the rays of the moon, more than the sun, because the sun can be scorching hot and wither up plant life, whereas the soothing rays of the moon, whether or not we can demonstrate that. I think, again, Krishna's saying here, the life of the world, the fact that the world provides sustenance for us through food, that is because of Krishna entering into it, Avishya. He is an immanent God. Now, again, how else has he entered it? Verse 14. You might recognise it. I've heard some people say this when they're at food times, this verse. I don't know. Let's do this one then. Aham vaishvanaro bhutva praninam deham ashritaha pranapana samayuktaha pachamyanam chaturvidam. Anybody recognise that one? Just must have been one person I was talking to then. Because he says, I'm situated in the bodies of all living beings, of the pranins, literally the breathing beings, deham in the body. Situated in the body of all living beings, I am the Vaishvanara. The Vaishvanara in Ayurveda is that fire within the belly that allows you to digest. Again, that energy of fire which enables is a manifestation of the energy, the power of Krishna. And he says, pranapana samayukta, becoming united with the prana and the apana, two of the breaths within the body. Pachamyanam chaturvidam. I cook, literally, the four types of food. I think the point here is that Krishna's making that as a deity, he's not in some remote Vaikuntha location, but he is to be identified as the pervasive force within the world that makes the world what it is. It makes it, it's a mystery why it's like that and not just lumps of stuff like the moon. It's an alive, pulsating world, and Krishna's saying here that is due to his own pervasive presence within the world. Now then, this is where he sums up the I think perhaps 15 relates to Krishna as well, but then he sums up, which is why we must finish. Am I all right still? You're not gonna not gonna... No. Okay, 15, right, okay, we got one longer verse here. Okay. Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto mutahasmitir gyanam apohanam cha vedoischa sarvairahameva vedyo vedanta krid veda videva chaham. Now he uses cha here, which means and as well. I'm also, I pervade the world, but I am hridi. Does anybody know what hrid means? The heart, yes. Hridi, again, it's locative. I am in the heart. Of who? Sarvasya, of every being. Sangnivishto, I am situated there in the heart of every living being. Which, again, Krishna is stating his identity with the Atman. He is present within the beings. Some people will say that he's... Some philosophers or interpreters, commentators will say there is also a distinctive manifestation of the deity sitting alongside the Atman, offering guidance. Others will interpret this verse as saying Krishna is here identifying himself as the Atman. Mata, from me comes remembrance, smriti, jnana, knowledge, apohana, and the loss of knowledge as well. So he guides the jiva bhuta through its cycle of life. He says, vedaischa sarvair ahameva vedyo. Now we're back with the Vedas again. What is the subject that's to be known from the Vedas? From all the Vedas. Vedaischa sarvair, vedya means to be known. What is the subject that should be understood? Aham. Which means I. Yes, so Krishna says, if you read the Vedas, the subject to be understood is myself. Which is interesting, because in not one of the Vedic hymns is Krishna mentioned. But so he is stating here that the revelation of the Vedas ultimately is of himself. Now, I don't think he's trying to say that all the hymns are really Krishna hymns, I think what he's saying is that where the Vedas reveal the absolute divinity, I am identified with that absolute divinity. And Vedanta Krid, I am the creator of the Vedanta philosophy. Vedavid, I am the one who understands the Vedas, he said. I'm not sure why he particularly says that. Vedanta Krid Vedavid, but that's what it means. I am the creator of Vedanta. Yeah, and I alone am the knower of the Vedas. We could debate that more, but I do want to. I don't want to overstay my welcome, and I'm concerned to look at the last five verses, because I do think that in these last five verses we get a succinct and significant exposition of one strand of Hindu philosophy. Okay, let's do 16 first. Dvadimau purushau loke ksharaschakshara evacha ksharahasarva bhutani kutrastokshara uchate. Now, dvau imau purushau. Dvau, anybody ever guess what that might mean? Two. Imau. These two purushas in the world. Locate, there are these two purushas. Two persons. The kshara and the akshara. Kshara means decaying. Akshara means non-decaying. He defines further in the second line, the ksharaha sarvabhutani is all living beings. The akshara, the apostrophe there stands for an A, is said to be kutasto. Kutasto is a difficult term. Kuta actually means the peak of a mountain, but it really means situated transcendence, is higher. So the kshara is all beings. The akshara is on a higher level than all beings. Who then are the two purushas? The kshara and the akshara. And it's hard to be wrong here because the commentators disagree. So who are the two persons? Who are these akshara and kshara? The body and the soul. Good, I agree with that. Anybody got an alternative?
Unenlightened soul and enlightened
soul. Very good, Jyoti. Yes, yes. I can't remember which commentator says which on this. And it's a debate. And different versions of the text, even such an august scholar as Professor Robert Zahner shares Jyoti's view on that. But I'm with you, sir. I think it means the body, the material person, and the spiritual soul. The reason why people suggest that it's two types of soul, the enlightened and the unenlightened, is the word purush, which often means the soul. But I think my suggestion is, and I'm not necessarily right by any means, that the kshara and akshara should be taken as indicating the spiritual component and the material component of the person. So therefore, there are these two. But it could be, and very learned commentators, far more learned than me, have suggested it means the soul in this world who is experiencing death, albeit through the body, and then the transcendent liberated soul. Okay, so we've got two sorts of purush. And now then, let's have a look at 17. Ready? Uttamah purushastvanyaha paramatme judahritaha yolokatrayamavishya bibhortya vyoya ishvaraha. Okay, uttama purush, anya. Uttama purush, what does uttama mean? The top purush, excellent, excellent. The top purush, and so uttama purush, two means but. So but, however, the uttama purush, the highest purush, is anya. What does anya mean?
Other.
Yeah, it means other. So the uttama purush is anya. It means different, the other. So what does that suggest then in relation to the jiva, the two purushas, the akshara purush, the kshara purush, and the uttama purush?
The atma is different from the uttama purush.
It is. And so therefore, whose philosophical viewpoint is this verse confirming?
Same as
Ramanuj, and possibly Madhva as well. It's also, interestingly, this passage of the Gita is, I think, central to the Swami Narayan point of view as well. Their Akshara Purushottam Sangsta is derived to a significant degree from this, although albeit with their own reading of it, you know, Akshara. Yeah, I think that's right. The Uttama Purush is different. What is the Uttama Purush known as? Udarita means he is known as Iti Udarita Paramatma. He is known as the Paramatma. And he is Anya. He is different from both the Kshara and the Akshara Purusha. So what I'm suggesting is that in these verses we do see the Gita displaying a significant tendency towards a more dualistic reading, a distinction being made between the Jiva Bhuta and the Paramatma, who is the highest Purusha. And the highest Purusha, having entered the three worlds, Lokatrayama Visha, he is the Avyaya Ishwara, the changeless Ishwar, who maintains the three worlds, Bibharat Lokatrayam. Okay, now then, how many principles have we got so far? Fundamental principles of the world we have. Right? Speak up, Nitin, come on. Courage.
Can... Three.
You're right, Nitin, yes, excellent. Three principles. We have Prakriti, the world, the tree. We have the Jiva Bhuta, Mame Vangsha, and then we have the Uttama Purusha. So I think this last few verses here are a summation of the previous sections. Now that's really interesting, because the three principles, the idea of there being three, is not original to the Gita. It goes back to the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is an interesting Upanishad. It's the most theistic of the Upanishads in the sense that it represents a personal deity, but it's also Shaivite in its orientation, in as much as it names the Uttama Purush as Rudra. It says there is Ekadeva Rudra Nam. There is one God called Rudra. And I'm absolutely convinced that the Gita here is drawing substantially on the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Although, in a recent letter, John Brockington wrote to me suggesting that maybe the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is later than the Gita and is drawing on the Gita. But I haven't read the books he suggested on that yet. But anyway, but I'm sticking to my guns on that, that the Gita is after the Upanishads. And therefore, it's drawing on the Shvetashvatara. And it's interesting because the orientation broadly of the Gita is Vaishnava, but it's drawing unhesitatingly on what is essentially a Shaivite Upanishad. But, and using that same philosophical notion of the three principles. And it's still interesting that in later Shaivism, in contemporary Shaivism, they still that have the same idea of there being three principles. The Shaiva Siddhanta philosophy has Pashu, Pash and Putti. Pashu means the beast, which is us, the soul. Pash is the ropes that bind us, which is the world. And Putti is the master. So it's the three principles. I suspect, although I'm not certain, that the Shaivite markings reflect that threefold. You know, the Shaivites tend to have three. I might be making that up, but I have a feeling that that is possibly the case, that why Shaivites, it reflects that. So in a sense, what we've got here, I think, is the Gita indirectly, perhaps via the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, drawing on what is essentially a Shaivite theological perspective, but definitely is making. Anyway, so we've got the three, and now then, we want the name of this person. So let's have a look in 18, where this Uttama Purush is finally identified. We know who he is and we know where he lives, sort of. Okay, verse 18. Yasmat ksharam atitoham aksharada pichotamaha atosmi loke vedecha pratitaha purushottamaha. Okay, yasmat really means because. Kshadamatito ham. Aham means I. Yes, we should say I, not not you, no. Okay. Because I am beyond the kshara. Aksharadapi chotamaha. I am supreme to the akshara as well. Therefore, asmi I am loke vedecha in the world, the popular talk of people, and in the revelation of the Vedas, pratitaha purushottama. I am established as purushottam. I remember doing this in Harrow when we used to have Purushottam Dabhasya there. He was identified as the supreme person when we read this verse. So who is this Uttama Purush? Turn it round, it's Purushottam. Uttama Purush, Purushottam. So who is it? What's his name, according to the Gita? Sorry? It's Krishna himself. Krishna claims he himself is the Uttama Purush beyond the other two. Okay, so that's, I like these verses, they move so nicely. Yeah, you've got two persons, the Kshara and the Akshara. Then there's an Uttama Purush who is different, who sustains the world. Because I'm beyond the Kshara and the Akshara, therefore I am known in both the world and in the Vedas as Purushottama. Now then, here we go. What should we do? Let's have a look. Verse 19. Verse 20 is really just a kind of a summing up of things. But verse 19 is the real conclusion. Look at that. 2 minutes to go. Let's do 19 then. Yo mamevam asamudo janati purushottamam sa sarvavid bhajati mam sarvabhavena bharata. Yeah, janati is the verb of the first line. It means understand or know. It's related to jnan, knowledge. So janati is a... So, who, yo, is who? Whoever thus knows me. Asamudo, undeluded. What does he know about me? Purushottam. So, in other words, the first line is saying, whoever thus knows me, being undeluded, as the Purushottam, he is designated as a sarvavid. Anybody think what sarvavid might mean? Sarvavid? All-knowing, he understands everything. He's reached the conclusion of knowledge. And what does he do, being now sarvavid? Bhajati mam. Sorry?
He worships.
Who does he worship?
Krishna.
Yes, Krishna. He worships Krishna. Sarvabhavena, with his whole being. Bharata is just evocative. He's just using that to address Arjuna. He worships me with his whole being. So these four little verses there. There's two persons, Kshara and Akshara, in 16. There's the Uttama Purush, who is different to them and beyond the world. And because Krishna has that role, he is that person, one who understands this, then worships Krishna. And we'll just do the last verse, which is basically saying this is a jolly good teaching, essentially. So verse 20 at the bottom there. Eti guhyatamam shastram idamuktam mayanaga etad budva buddhiman syat kritakrityascha bharata. It's guhyatamam shastram. It's the most secret. A guhya is a hidden thing. It's the most mysterious, profound shastra. This which I have spoken, maya, spoken by me, anaga, sinless one. Having understood this, etad budva, a buddhiman, a wise one, has completed everything that he has to complete. He's kritakritya. He's reached the conclusion of his life, if you can understand this religious truth. Anyway, well done. Excellent. And look at that, right on time. Just to sum up, it's a complete treatise in itself. And again, it comes back to what we were talking about, we were discussing at lunchtime, the onset of really theistic notions within India. The Gita is almost certainly a pre-Christian text, but you can see here how it develops strongly theistic lines. Now, Shankara has his own reading of these verses, but what it seems is that it is, in a sense, a monotheistic treatise. There is one deity, one Purushottam, who is Krishna. The conclusion of knowing that Krishna is that one supreme deity is that the person therefore worships him. And I think in that way, the idea of bhakti, devotion to a single God, is given credentials within a Vedantic context. Vedanta as Anna says, is based on these Prasthantraya, these three foundations of Upanishads, Brahma Sutras and Bhagavad Gita. It's hard to find bhakti within the Upanishads, but clearly in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedantists of a dualistic devotional tendency, and Ramanuja epitomizes that. And of course, Ramanuja's great successors, he wasn't a voice alone. He's had a whole school of thought who've expanded on his teachings in various different ways. The point I would make is that it is justified for these teachers to turn to the Gita and say, our devotional ideas are expressions of worship, love, and surrender to a supreme deity are not non-Vedic, non-Vedantic inventions, but we can point to a text like the Gita and see that devotionalism, bhakti, is entirely within the purview of the Vedantic revelation. Okay? What do we do? Do we do questions or do we have to stop?
You just have to recite it now by turning it over.
Having memorized it. Or, does anybody have any questions or comments or anything?
Can I ask a related question?
Yes, of course.
You know the Swami Narayan Sanskrit, EAPS, Akshar Purushottam. What do those two words mean, Akshar and Purushottam, in the context of what you've just been talking about?
Well, that's why I say, I mean, you can see that Akshara and Purushottam are terms that are used within this section of the Gita. My understanding, as I recall, of Swami Narayan theology is quite distinctive, maybe somebody knows better than me, but as I recall, the Swami Narayan postulates the idea that there is the Akshara, who is the Purushottam is Swami Narayan himself, and Akshara is his first immediate associate, whose name momentarily, do you know who it was, Jyoti? His immediate, who's represented as sorry, Gunatita Swami is represented as being the Akshara. So, and I don't see, I mean, I think that's a reading from this chapter. I don't think that Krishna was trying to say in this chapter. In other words, it's, I don't want to say it's wrong, but it's not the obvious meaning of what's being stated in this chapter. And I think that theological position is derived from this rather than being a very close reflection of what it's saying, in other words. And of course, if you go into a Swami Narayan temple, you'll see on the altar there will be Swami Narayan himself as Purushottam, and it is Gunatita who's standing next to him usually. And I think also Pramukh Swami is regarded as, isn't he an inheritor of the Akshara identity as well? So the Akshara is handed down through the chain of gurus there. But, you know, the original notion is contained here, but I think the Swami Narayan teaching has travelled a considerable distance from that originally, although using the same language.
So what's the significance of this chapter? They always recite this at funerals.
Sorry, George, you're saying?
This chapter is always recited at funerals, and I don't understand the significance.
Is it? I suppose it gives the idea of the transcendence of the soul and the transmigration of the soul moving on to one body, but I didn't know it was used at funerals. I mean, it does represent, isn't the second chapter sometimes, the transcendence of the soul and the fact that the soul moves on from death. Yeah, so so that even though the person has departed, the soul, along with the aromas, metaphorically, that it gathered in life, has passed on to another state of being, in the sense that death is not absolute.
The soul is immortal.
The soul is immortal.
The soul is immortal. It leaves the body. You know, it'll be like you'll be changing another dress, you'll be going into another body, but the soul, passes on. That's how...
But it doesn't pass on alone, because although the physical body is left behind, I think the idea is that there's a linga sharira as well, a subtle body consisting of mind which carries with it the sanskaras, the impressions with it, because the soul is always untouched by anything. I think Krishna says, Padma Putra Mivambasar, it's like a lotus leaf untouched by water. You know, water comes in contact, but it doesn't change the nature of the lotus leaf. So the soul is always untouched. But what is affected by your actions and in your experiences is the subtle body, which enshrouds the soul as it goes forth and moves into the next body. It's an interesting point, the connection between one life and another. You know, so that how much of what I am now is carried into my next life, so that when I'm reborn as a dog in my next life, will I still be Nick Sutton running around in a doggy body thinking the sort of thoughts I think about, like football and stuff like that in my head? But I won't be, will I? I'll just be Rover, won't I? I'll be thinking about about doggo meat and
say you forget, you know, you're not supposed to remember, you don't remember.
Even though you
have the sanskars, but you don't actually remember. That's why when you're born, you know, I don't remember anything.
Can't get rid of the piggy smells that easily.
They're still there, but they're in the background. They're not
background,
conscious thoughts.
Imprinted, all the things that have been imprinted on your soul carries on. But that's why they say that you can be a family of four, and everyone's different. You have four
Absolutely.
Children, they can all be different.
Oh, yeah.
There are some certain qualities that are the same, but... Mm-hmm. So where does he get his artistic talent from? Then that goes back to your previous...
I think any parent who's got more than one child will be aware of the fact that they come into the world already significantly formed with their own personality traits, which are manifest right from the... right from birth, aren't they? You can see what they were like there. And that would be the based on the belief they're the sort of aromas that they've carried forward with them from the past life. So I suppose in that sense it does fit in with a kind of conceptualising about the nature of death and the nature of transmigration.
Yeah. Is there a story, a long time ago, I heard this story where, I don't know if it's Arjun and Krishna talking about two men, they're walking along, Arjun sees two people. One is a fat sort of rich guy, you know, doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
He's just, you know, enjoying life and all the rest of it. And then there's some poor beggar who's a devotee and he's doing everything right.
Mm.
But he's really poor and he gets beaten up and all sorts of things. And Arjun says to Krishna, this is very unfair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this poor guy, he's doing everything right and he's still getting the, you know, a very hard life.
Mm.
This rich fat guy is getting everything, and why is, you know, you're very unjust.
Mm.
And I can't remember what Krishna said.
What
he says is that this person is paying for the karmas of his previous life,
yeah.
The guy that was poor.
Yeah.
And the rich guy, he has been good in his previous life, but now in his next life,
yeah.
It's a cycle, isn't it? It's just going round and round.
Yeah, but I mean,
and this thing about moksha, I keep talking to Dutty about moksha. I personally don't believe in it at all because it. I can't see this cycle breaking for you to go to that other level.
Well, I mean, the paths to moksha are broadly twofold. We talked about the different yogas. I mean, for Shankara, the way of gaining moksha is just that higher, utterly transcendent realization. And it's interesting when Krishna teaches jnana and meditation in the Gita, chapter 6, you know, controlling the mind and realizing the Atman, which again gives you that higher knowledge, which Arjun says, basically, have you got anything a bit easier than that? I don't think I could I can manage that. And it's at that point that that Krishna introduces the notion of himself and the idea of bhakti. And Ramanuj in particular and his school of thought have developed this idea that moksha comes not as a result of... personal achievement and transcending yourself, but it just comes out of the act of a love of God, and you know that God. I think Ramanuj in one place in his writing says it's like a father whose son is away at school studying, and the father loves the son, and even though it's not time for him to return, he's a powerful man. So he says, all right, it's breaking all the rules. I'm just going to get him and bring him home because I want him near me. So he's not qualified for moksha, but I just like him. I love him and I want to come and get him. And there's that verse which the Ramanuja Sampradaya repeats almost daily, I think, you know, at the end of the Gita, Sarva Dharmam Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja, which means you give up all these dharmas. Don't worry too much about them. Just depend upon me. Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. It's the same with Pushti Marg, isn't it? That their mantra as well. Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama. They recite that. I'm your shelter. And he said, as a Aham Tva Sarva Papebhyo Moksha Ishami. In that verse there, Krishna, it's in the first person singular, Moksha Ishami. I will moksha you. Aham Tva Moksha Ishami. So I'll do it to you. It's what Anu was saying about grace. So although moksha might, and I agree, it seems inconceivable. You know, have you ever tried doing that yoga Krishna talks about in chapter 6? And stopping the mind wondering, after a couple of months, you think, I'm just getting nowhere with this. But then Krishna offers the alternative that he will do it for you. He'll take care of it. But, I mean, again, it's what I was talking about last time. Is it rationally conceivable that this can happen? It depends upon the individual completely. And as for the question, I'm a little bit, you know, the point of the story, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that. And years ago, I saw Alan Wicker. You remember Alan Wicker, the sort of interview? He was in Bollywood, and he was interviewing this Bollywood cinema star. I don't know who she was. They all look incredibly beautiful, but not always... anyway, I don't want to insult him, but they don't always seem the sharpest sort of individuals, do they, when he was interviewing? And he was saying to her... sorry, am I being unfair to film stars? Yeah. But he was saying to her, in his enigmatic Alan Wicker style, he said, here we are, you're living in absolute luxury all around, you've got everything you want, you've got, you know, million servants, everything, and yet within 2 miles of where we are here in Bombay, there are thousands of people struggling for a meal. How do you feel about that? And she said, well, of course, that's a very Western question, because we in India understand that this is all down to the law of karma. In my previous life, I've acted, so I'm enjoying this, and they've acted in that way. And I thought, oh, that's, it's not quite right somehow. And I think it becomes very easy then to say, yeah, I'm enjoying the good life and everything, and I've just got what's coming to me, and these poor fellows, well, they deserve it, don't they, because they must have been. And... I'm not saying that's what happened, but it can sort of develop a slightly pernicious form of quietism and approach towards the world. But I suppose theoretically, it's true, isn't it? It's like, wasn't it Glenn Hoddle was sacked as the England manager for saying that disabled people were suffering past... Which goes to show that no Hindu or no Buddhist can ever manage the English football team, can they? Because they would hold to that.
View. Or no disabled person because it's their bad karma.
Yeah.
You'll never get the karma for it. Thank you very much, Nick.
Okay. Thank you.